This will be taken under advisement. The next case this morning is number 012832, Father and Mother against James Cassidy. Ms. Solomon, let's let the court empty out for a minute, okay?
You're losing your audience. That's fine. I have the three I need.
It's hard to believe none of these people care if you get your costs or not.
I think we can get underway. Thank you for waiting.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Plaintiffs filed this case in federal court and then dismissed it after 2 years of intense, costly litigation. The question this case presents is whether the district court abused its discretion when it dismissed the federal claims with prejudice and yet refused to award the city its costs of the federal litigation. Our submission on this issue is in two parts. First, as it has long been settled in this circuit, a defendant is a prevailing party under Rule 54 when the federal claims are resolved in its favor, even if state claims are dismissed without prejudice.
Now, technically, this has to have been essentially a supplemental jurisdiction dismissal with the federal claims resolved with prejudice and then leaving the parties free, if they so chose, to refile the state claims.
The state claims were
Without prejudice.
They were dismissed without prejudice.
Right. Because otherwise it would be claim preclusion on everything.
That is correct. The federal claims were dismissed without prejudice. The state claims, without prejudice. That was the precise situation in at least three prior cases that we cited in our brief. The Ogborn case, the Contreras case, and Congregation of the Passions, a little less clear, but the holding of Ogborn on the Rule 54 issue is that the local 888 was the prevailing party, even though the state claims were dismissed without prejudice, because the federal claims were dismissed with prejudice. So that's the first piece, that when federal claims are resolved in favor of the defendant, even when state claims are dismissed without prejudice, the defendant is the prevailing party.
Can I ask you a question here? If you're right, would this case have to be remanded for a finding of ability to pay?
No, Your Honor, it would not, for two reasons. First, there's no cross appeal here. The judgment that comes to this court is a yes or no question. Either we're entitled to our costs or we're not. It's the only question in front of the court.
But wait, could I ask you about that? Because Rule 54D1 certainly does say, except when otherwise provided, costs other than attorney's fees shall be allowed, as of course, to the prevailing party unless the court otherwise directs. Now, as I understand your argument, the district court judge never made that decision, never made the otherwise directs decision, because the district court judge thought that this could all be delegated over somehow to the state court. But wouldn't we at least need a remand for the exercise of that discretion?
Actually, I think that otherwise direct was made. The district court decided that the costs would be punted to the state court. That was the direction the district court was giving on the costs. It gave that direction.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is if that kind of delegation is inappropriate, I mean, I've always understood the unless the court otherwise directs language to cover, say, the situation where the victory is so technical as to not justify an order of cost. It doesn't cover very much. I mean, there's case law that says it's a very narrow.
It has been narrowly construed. The only two exceptions this court has ever recognized are misconduct worthy of a penalty and inability to pay. And I want to get back to Judge Evans' question on that. the inability to pay, you can trace it all the way back to Badillo, and you're just never going to find a lot of satisfaction there. Badillo simply announces that inability to pay is a factor to consider. And it cites two cases, neither of which actually holds that. In fact, they both reject it. But in this case, it's very simple, because the district court made no finding that the city was had committed any misconduct worthy of a penalty. The penalty here is $100,000. So it needs to be more than maybe we filed one extra document. It needs to be substantial misconduct. The costs in this case are very, very large. There was no finding made of any misconduct. The plaintiffs do not argue that we committed any misconduct. They didn't place it before the district court. They don't argue it on appeal. They also don't argue that they are unable to pay. And, of course, they could hardly argue that when they're suing us in state court for many millions of dollars. There might be a question about enforceability of the cost judgment, but there certainly is no issue whether they might ever be able to pay.
Now, you said something in your reply brief that intrigued me on that to relate it over to the state court, which was, as you envision this happening, you should get your costs right now for the federal court action, which was resolved in your favor once the judgment with prejudice was entered. Then, at some later date, if the plaintiffs were to prevail in the state court and if they were able to convince the state court that perhaps some of the discovery that was undertaken here in the federal court contributed to their victory, maybe the state court could give them costs that would somehow pull some of this back from you. But your position is let that happen then if it ever
does.
That
is correct.
Yeah.
Rule 54 is very clear. There is no exception in Rule 54 for cases that are going to be continuing in state court. In this case, this court has held on at least three occasions, Ogborn, Contreras, Congregation of the Passion, that the mere fact that there are state claims dismissed with prejudice does not mean that the defendant is the prevailing party even where that happens. The second piece of it, and this court has not precisely addressed this piece, is whether that rule applies even to a Rule 41A2 dismissal, a voluntary dismissal. We do not find a case from this court precisely on that issue, but it is the square holding of the Tenth Circuit in Aerotech. That is exactly the situation in Aerotech. The district court denied Estes' request for costs under Rule 54 after the claims against him were dismissed with prejudice under Rule 41. The Tenth Circuit held that that made Estes a prevailing party, and it reversed the district court for refusing to award him costs. When you put the two of these together, the mere fact that state claims are dismissed without prejudice does not deprive us of prevailing party status, and that rule applies anyway, even on to Rule 41. When you put those together, the district court's abuse of discretion here requires that its judgment be reversed and the court be directed to entertain the bill of costs. I reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. Ms. Hussler.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. I think the city makes a very important admission that this court has never ruled that Rule 54 applies in a Rule 41 case.
But where's the exception? I mean, once you have a dismissal with prejudice, Rule 41 certainly makes it clear that that counts as an adjudication on the merits. And I don't see any real inconsistency between 41 and 54. Then you just plug into what happens to you if you get the case resolved in your favor, however that may have happened, motion, 41, you know, jury verdict or whatever, and you get your cause. And I guess the other thing that troubled me very much about what the district court did is this notion of delegating federal costs to a state court when the rules are different, when there's nothing in the statutes or federal rules that say that you can do such a thing. It seems,
well, I think
talk
I can
about unprecedented. It seems really unprecedented.
I think I can answer your question by stepping back a little bit and asking you to suspend belief for a moment as to the application of Rule 54 and look at what the district court did. Rule 54 did not come into play and was not an issue before the district court. This was a voluntary dismissal under Rule 41A2. That's what everybody argued, and that's what everybody understood. And the reasons for dismissing were very clear.
And if it had wound up without prejudice, you wouldn't be here, because a without prejudice dismissal is not an adjudication in favor of one party or the other.
But I think what the judge did in the district court was totally within the discretion that's allowed her under Rule 41. It was very broad discretion, and that is to decide whether the dismissal is with or without prejudice, whether to award costs to the defendant.
But she didn't. If she had just issued an order saying, I'm exercising my discretion under 54D1 to refuse to give costs, I'm otherwise directing, period, full stop, then at least the appeal would be focused on whether her reason fell within those reasons that this court has recognized as permissible or if that had been an abuse of discretion. She went a step further. She seemed to think that she could sort of fold the federal litigation into what was going on in the state court and ask the state court to make a federal ruling somehow.
Well, I understand. What the judge did was she looked at this under Rule 41 and not under Rule 54. I don't think that any case that the defendant cited requires that she, even with prejudice, that the judge had to apply Rule 54.
Where do you get that, though? Where does Rule 54 drop out? Once she made that crucial decision to make it a with prejudice dismissal, which, as you point out, was very late in the day, and that's unfortunately probably why some of this confusion arose.
Well, I don't think that issue was even before the court because I don't think the defendants argued it in the first place.
Oh, sure, they did. As soon as they had a chance.
Well, judge told us on June 12th that she was going to convert. We asked for a voluntary dismissal without prejudice, and she said, I will grant that, but upon the refiling of your claims in state court, it will convert into a dismissal with prejudice. That was June 12th. We don't see any argument about Rule 54 from the defendants until after the order is entered. And they don't even raise it in their docketing statement.
Well, I think that's accurate. The judge really didn't see this one coming.
Well, I think why not is because she was under Rule 41, which offers her very broad discretion under Crawley and under Marlowe. The district court has very broad discretion to determine the terms and conditions in conjunction with a dismissal, whether it's with prejudice or without prejudice. The fact that what she said was, look, this litigation is the same litigation whether it's in federal court or in state court, whether there are federal claims or not. All the work that was done, except she said maybe a little bit of the Monell litigation, is going to go ahead to the state court. So there's no disadvantage to the defendants here. And I'm not going to award costs because there aren't any incurred that aren't going to be useful in litigating the subsequent litigation in state court. She's entitled to do that under Rule 41. That's what she did, and I understand.
But she said, "I'm going to let the state court make the final cost order."
She did do that.
And I think that just can't be done. I don't see how a federal court can delegate. She needed to confront Rule 54 once she had a decision. Now she could have said, "Because of the wide discretion I have under Rule 41, that." Maybe another reason for otherwise directing and integrate the two rules together somehow. There are things one could imagine saying that might make this a possible ruling, but I don't see her thinking about it.
Well, before we get to whether the state she can impose on the state court what it has to do about the cost, I think the important issue is that the way she envisioned Rule 54 costs and how it came in was looking at it as Rule 54 would normally apply after litigation on the merits is concluded.
But it was over. It was over for the federal claims, and you didn't want to raise the federal claims in state court because the city would have just removed it right back to the federal court. They do all the time.
That's true, but it was over not under Rule 54.
It was over. Rule 54 doesn't say when there's a dismissal under Rule 12, do this. When there's a dismissal under Rule 41, do that. When there's a Rule 50 ruling, do something else.
Well, the only way I can respond to that is to say that it's very clear from the record below that Judge Lefkoe was ruling under Rule 41 because the cases authorized her to do that. And when
I don't have a problem with her ruling under Rule 41 at all. It's just that then what's next? Then there's a piece of paper that says judgment in the city's favor with prejudice.
Well, If you're correct, Your Honor, then the city should have raised that the minute that Judge Lefkoe said, I'm going to convert this to dismissal with prejudice. It didn't occur to them until afterwards, because her discretion to defer the cost to the end of the case were the costs in all of the litigation, when it could best be determined what costs were duplicative and
but
should not be reimbursed.
But you're assuming the end of the case is the end of the state case.
Absolutely.
And I guess the city's crucial point is the end of the case is the end of the federal case, and it was over.
Well, that isn't how Judge Lefkoe saw it.
Well, I'm just saying, we're here to review Judge Lefkoe.
I understand
we're
that.
We're not here to defer to Judge Lefkoe.
No, I understand that, but I do think it's important that we, in order to review her, to see that her exercise of discretion was under Rule 41. The defendants have cited absolutely no authority that limits her discretion to do what she did, to say, even though this is going to be a dismissal with prejudice, under Rule 41, the terms and conditions of this dismissal, because she looked at the absolute practicalities, that the evidence that was developed in the discovery in federal court was going to the state court litigation. She said, this litigation isn't over. You're just going to another courthouse. Same parties, same issues, another forum. Therefore, there is no disadvantage to the defendants. The only thing the defendants raised about Rule 54 in the district court before they filed their notice of appeal was that it wasn't fair to them that the plaintiff's costs get deferred to the end of the state court litigation as well, because the plaintiff shouldn't get the benefit of a voluntary dismissal. That's the only thing they raised, and that's not what they're appealing here. I think they've waived their issue completely. I'd like to address the fact that they're making an end run around Judge Lefkoe. She never had an opportunity to rule on this theory that they raised after they filed the notice of appeal, that they surprised us. We never got to contest or litigate the applicability of Rule 54 to our voluntary dismissal. Further factual development is required. The Rule 54 cost that they've petitioned for is still pending in front of Judge Lefkoe. The issues about indigency of the plaintiffs have never been litigated. The issues about the extraordinary cost that they've submitted and whether they will be applicable to the subsequent litigation have never been litigated. This appeal is very premature.
Could you explain that? The issue is still before Judge Lefkoe?
That's correct.
How does that happen?
Well, I think that's a good question. The city didn't raise the Rule 54 issue before Judge Lefkoe, and it was only after they filed the notice of appeal to challenge her exercise of discretion under Rule 41A2 that it dawned on them that if they basically disingenuously represented that they had argued that they were entitled to costs as prevailing parties for the federal claims, that they could get some money now, because the standard under Rule 54 is much, much stricter than the standard under Rule 41.
But also the standard in state court is quite different, too. I thought that there was an attempt to raise something before Judge Lefkoe, and she said, I don't have any jurisdiction over this.
After the appeal.
The appeal has been filed.
Yes.
She doesn't have something actively pending before.
No, she stated, but there is something alive. They filed a bill of costs after they filed the notice of appeal, and said that they were entitled to over $100,000 worth of costs. We filed a motion to strike the bill of costs, and the judge, instead of handling the bill of costs, said, I'm going to stay this. You've appealed this. I don't think I have any jurisdiction to rule on this. But none of that's been litigated.
Well, I asked Ms. Solomon, if we were to reverse, would the district court then have an opportunity to decide whether your client can absorb these costs? And it looks like you're saying that there is a matter stayed in the district court on that issue.
Absolutely. There's very much a live issue about whether they're entitled to a single dime of the over $100,000 of costs that they've asked for. And we will definitely litigate that. And the district judge, it's a concession by the part of the defendants that the district judge has never had an opportunity to pass on this.
But how do you litigate? I'm just really confused now. How do you litigate that if we were to reverse and say they're entitled to their costs, period?
Well, I think what you do then is you open a can of worms, because under Rule 41, which is what the dismissal was pursuant to, the plaintiff is entitled to decide once it is aware of what the terms and conditions are, and that would be the cost that they petitioned for. If the district judge tells the plaintiff, I'm going to make you pay costs against the defendants, then plaintiffs get an opportunity to say, we don't like those terms and conditions attached to the voluntary dismissal, and we would prefer to proceed to trial in federal court, or the plaintiff can decide to accept the terms and conditions after they've been.
But you didn't file a conditional cross appeal. I mean, it seems to me the straightforward thing is to say the district court did not exercise her discretion properly under Rule 54. She should have decided, without regard to the state court proceedings, whether costs should be awarded, as of course, to the prevailing party, or whether to direct otherwise. Then consider whatever you want to say. You know, we can't pay, we're indigent, you know, whatever the internal to the federal proceeding issues are. It seems to me pretty easy.
Well, I think the flaw in the reasoning is at the very beginning, and that is that the district court judge never got a chance to exercise her discretion under Rule 54.
But if we remanded it, if she did exercise it, we were told, in the direction of telling the state court to do it. But if we were to say that was wrong, and there were remand, there would be every opportunity for you to say whatever you want to say. But
well,
you didn't conditionally cross appeal and say the 41A dismissal was wrong.
No, I don't think anybody disputes that the 41A dismissal was wrong. Everybody conceded that.
You're saying you might not have wanted to do it now.
The terms and conditions matter very much to a plaintiff, and Cawley and Marlowe particularly are cases that say that a plaintiff gets to decide. It has to be a knowing and intelligent decision, knowing what terms and conditions they're accepting. Now, you could remand it very narrowly, I think, to say that the exercise of the exercise of the discretion under Rule 41 was appropriate. It wasn't an abuse of discretion. There was no legal prejudice to the defendants, but we're troubled by the deferral of the cost to the state court, and
The city's a prevailing party now, and it gets its costs unless otherwise directed.
Well, I think that we would be robbed of the opportunity to have litigated whether Rule 54 applied, because we never got to litigate that. The city never raised it. It was an issue that the district court never got to pass on. This is totally an end run around Judge Lefkoe's Rule 41 order.
Why can't we decide it?
Well, there's factual issues to be determined. I don't understand how the
relationship between Rule 41 and Rule 54 is a matter of law.
Well, that's a matter of law.
The other? I mean, surely this court can decide that.
But whether Rule 54 applies to this case and whether it's ever been litigated by the parties in front of the district court to have an opportunity to pass on it before you then decide what the interrelationship is between the rules. I think this appeal is very premature, and I regret that we're even before you, because I think the fact that the issue is still pending stayed in front of Judge Lefkoe is a concession on the part of the city that they didn't do this before they filed the notice of appeal.
But it would be too late for them to appeal when the state court proceeding is over, because their time to file a notice of appeal began running when the case was disposed of, when a final judgment was entered in the federal court. They can't wait.
No, but they also could have raised this issue in a timely fashion if they thought it was an issue before the district court. They didn't do that. It did not occur to them, because everyone in the district court understood, the plaintiffs, the defendants, and the court, that this was Rule 41A2, and that the district court had the discretion to set terms and conditions, which included, city, I am not going to award you any costs for this voluntary dismissal with prejudice, because there's no prejudice to you. There's nothing to offset, because everything you used in the federal litigation, you're going to use over here in the state court litigation. And so there's no reason to award costs. The deferral of costs were not about the dismissal. It was, let's see who wins at the end of the litigation on the merits, and that person will get their costs. If the defendants prevail, plaintiffs pay the defendants' costs for the whole litigation, including
under a state standard, of course, not a federal standard, which is different.
Well, what she ordered was that the costs incurred.
Did she compel the state court to use a federal standard for costs?
Well, I think what she said was she didn't understand why the state court wouldn't go along with her order.
But they have separate rules. how many hours of depositions. You know, it's a real mess, actually.
Well, that is true, but I don't think for the same reasons. I think it's a mess because we didn't get to litigate the issue that they've appealed. And if we're going to get a remand, then I think we start over, and our Rule 41 request for voluntary dismissal then is open and fresh, and the judge can then decide what terms and conditions, and we can decide to accept or reject them, and then either proceed to trial in federal court or stay in state court. I see that my time
is up. Thank you, Ms. Sussman.
Thank you so much.
Solomon, you have 3 minutes, but I'm going to add another two to that because we had quite a few questions for your opposing counsel.
I hope to be brief, Your Honor, but thank you very much. Let me start, in case I was unclear in responding to your question, Judge Evans. The bill of costs was filed, as we believe the local rule might have required us to do, within a specified time after the district court's judgment in this case. And we filed it even though we were appealing the denial of costs because we weren't sure whether there would be a tolling or not. The Congregation of the Passion opinion is a little unclear exactly how the timing would run. So we filed the bill of costs, and it was stayed in the district court. When I responded to your question, you know, what is open on remand, what I intended to point out was that the bill of costs in terms of amount and documentation and any other issue that ever, you know, that usually gets litigated on a bill of costs is open, and we would expect to address it in the district court on remand if the court agrees with us that it was an abuse of discretion not to require an award of the costs now. But that's the only issue that we believe is open on remand. Because the plaintiffs did not file a conditional cross appeal to raise any other issue, including the Marlowe issue, we believe that those issues are not properly before the district court at this time. And, you know, let me go back and kind of chart how the issues came up so there is no confusion on this. As Judge Wood noted, this did start as a request for a dismissal under Rule 41, but it moved on from there. They wanted to dismiss. They have dismissed. We're not challenging the dismissal. The only thing that we challenged was the failure to award the city its costs, even though we are the prevailing party in this litigation. There's no exception in Rule 54 for cases that are continuing in state court. There's no exception in Rule 54 for voluntary dismissal. Rule 54 actually says that it applies, costs are required, unless there's some other rule that also requires them, unless some other provision is made for them. And Rule 41 certainly does not make any kind of provision for them, so Rule 41 is not an exception. And the Aerotech case from the 10th Circuit is squarely on point on that issue. To decide the voluntary dismissal issue differently here would simply raise a conflict with the Aerotech case. Now, as far as how the Rule 54 issue came up, it did come up on the court's own motion. Perhaps she injected it because we asked for fees in addition to costs in opposing the motion for voluntary dismissal without prejudice. And there are certainly cases that say that fees, attorney's fees, can be awarded. Now, it moved on from there. We're not complaining about any of that. But the district court was well aware the issue in this case was Rule 54. The plaintiffs were well aware this issue was Rule 54. The plaintiffs were actually the first party to raise the issue of Rule 54. They put it in the proposed stipulation after the June 12th hearing. We go to court on June 12th and we say, what are we going to do? The district court says, well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to dismiss this thing, the federal claims, with prejudice. Now, you go and work out how you think we're going to deal with the cost. They send us a proposed stipulation. The stipulation has Rule 54 in it. They weren't surprised by Rule 54. The district court's ruling is in terms of Rule 54. She says, Rule 54 costs are going to travel to the state court. Everybody understood the issue was Rule 54. She let her ruling stand, even though she was aware there were problems with that ruling, squaring that ruling under Rule 54. We pointed out those problems in the motion for clarification. Everybody was aware that we were complaining that punting the issue to the state court violated Rule 54. And you know, the plaintiffs were aware of Marlowe also. They cited that in their reply in support of the motion for expedited pretrial conference. When we came in response to the motion for voluntary dismissal and said, fine, dismiss, but we want fees and costs, they cited Marlowe. They said, you know what, if you're going to do that, we have a right to withdraw our motion. They were aware of the right to withdraw the motion. There was a cross appeal in Marlowe. Marlowe was aware, everybody in Marlowe was aware of that you needed a cross appeal, and they were aware of Marlowe. And they, in the district court, they even allowed that they would appeal the district court's ruling, and they didn't. Without the cross appeal, the issue, if we are correct that it was an abuse of discretion to deny the cost of the federal litigation at this time, we ask that the issue be returned to the district court to adjudicate the bill of costs solely on its own terms, not with regard to indigency, and we respectfully request that the judgment be reversed. Thank you.
My thanks to both Ms. Solomon and Ms. Sussler for the